Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is the Soundcheck Podcast.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The writer and director Jim Jarmusch has been making movies for more than 30 years, but he's been making music even longer. His current band, called Squirrel, did much of the music for his last feature film, The Only Lovers Left Alive, and now Squirrel is creating a new soundtrack for four silent films by the famed 20th century American artist Man Ray. That'll be premiered at Brookfield Place in Lower Manhattan on February 17th and 19th. And Jim Jarmusch joins us here in the Soundcheck studio. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you, John.
When did you first discover the Man Ray films?
Wow, I think I saw them in the mid-70s for the first time, because I studied in Paris for a little while through Columbia, and I got incompletes in most of my classes because I became addicted to the Cinematheque in Paris. So I saw so many things there that I'm pretty sure that's where I first saw at least Étoile de Mer, maybe his more famous film.
Right, right. And so what did you think of them? I mean, they're abstract films as opposed to narrative.
Well, they are definitely, these four films that we are going to perform scores to are all from the 20s. And so he was right in the peak of the surrealist movement. So they are, I don't know how formal surrealism is, but these are definitely surrealist films in the true sense of the word. So they employ kind of dream logic. They do not care for plot or conventions. They are sometimes abstract images from his photograms, his rayogram techniques. Sometimes they're live-action photography, but filmed through distorted glass or lots of distortion. And, well, yes, they're very abstract and very, very beautiful, non-literal films.
Yeah. And how important was that? Well, I'm going to ask in a moment how important that was to you, because to anyone who knows your work, a lot of what you just said is going to have a certain resonance. But how important do you think these films were in the history of film, of cinema?
Well, I think looking back at them, they are truly remarkable films. They are really amazing, and I think maybe undervalued, but I don't know how you value these things. But for me, rediscovering them and now watching them over and over, they are really striking. So I think they're incredible pieces of the history of cinema, of non-narrative cinema, of experimental photography, of non-literalness,
right.
You know? So they're really remarkable.
And stumbling upon them as a budding filmmaker yourself, do you, I mean, maybe not at the time, but with the benefit of hindsight, do you see kind of lingering after images of that in your own work?
Well, I don't know. You know, when I was at that age in my early 20s, and especially when I discovered the Cinematheque in Paris and saw all these, you know, my mind was blown from all directions. I was seeing classic Japanese films. I was seeing these experimental films. You know, it was kind of an amazing inundation for me.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is, you know, with Man Ray, as opposed to a lot of other films that were being done in the 20s, is, you know, film was seen as a narrative art form. And here's a guy who comes along, and I know there were others doing this too, but, you know, as you say, goes for something that's non-literal, that does not have, if there is a logic, it's a dream logic. And when I think of some of your movies, and the one that pops to mind is Limits of Control, where there's a kind of a dream logic to the way scenes kind of repeat, and they're slightly different, and the way you get to the denouement of the final scene is not clearly logically explained.
It's like a game. Deception. Suspicion.
How did you get in here?
I used my imagination.
Well, you know, there's a direct connection in a way, not really stylistically, but when we made Limits of Control, our kind of oblique strategy was to try to not provide expectations to the audience. So we remove things like plot and action and drama and, you know, all kinds of things to see, can we make a film we think is a beautiful film without these expectations, removing them all? And, of course, a lot of people decided no. But but Man Ray did the same thing. And in exactly, not certainly not stylistically similar, but he removed all the things that people were expecting, narrative films, some kind of plot and relationships between people, all of these things, a kind of story. He removed all those things. He just was not interested in them.
Well, now, you used the term oblique strategies, which is the deck of problem-solving cards that Brian Eno and the artist Peter Schmidt created in the 70s. And of course, Eno, known for doing with music what you just talked about in film, you know, stripping away the story, the narrative, and just kind of leaving the thing itself.
Yeah.
I mean, for you musically, that tension between abstract and narrative in music, is that important to you as well?
It is to me, because my musical tendencies are, and I'm not a trained musician, but I have very strong, I would say, musical tendencies, intentions, you know. And I would say the Man Ray films are very, very musical in a way. I mean, imagistically, I don't know what words to use, but there's something very rhythmic and musical and lyrical even about them. But for me, the kind of music I make, or we make, is not structured entirely. It's not based on necessarily existing forms, although we do write some songs with verses and choruses.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, when these live scores are going to be performed by myself and Carter Logan, we'll be using guitars, distorted guitars, drums, some percussion, but also keyboards and old... Well, I have an old, like, retro keyboard from the 80s. Carter uses a Moog. We will be using some loops and things. So we're distorting the sound often.
Right.
It's kind of drone-oriented. We have maps. We've been rehearsing. We follow our maps, but every time we play, it's different.
Right.
So there's an improvisational element that's very important. And we're not trying to literally punctuate everything in the films. I think Man Ray would be appalled by a literal musical interpretation. So,
what they call Mickey Mousing, where
do they?
Yeah,
like, well, none of that.
Right, none of that. Where, you know, if somebody gets hit with a 2x4 on the back of the head, you have a little
right
at
but
exactly
I think
that moment.
If Man Ray wants you to see the ocean, he'd rather hear a freight train. You know, I'm taking liberties, but I'm pretty familiar with his work and his life. So, you know, we're trying to do something very respectful to what he did. And there's a funny correlation between surrealism and a kind of link to psychedelia in an odd way, because both of them have to do with the unconsciousness or the expansion of your consciousness. Both of them are non-logical. So they tap in. Our music is a bit psychedelic, and it's by nature. Every time we just like humming, throbbing, distorted drones, you know. So we build things using those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's kind of a trippy experience to watch his films with our scores. Hopefully,
well, the world premiere of these scores is at Brookfield Place, the former World Financial Center, in the Winter Garden Atrium on February 17th and 19th. It's part of my annual New Sounds Live silent film series, Jim Jarmusch and Carter Logan. So Squirrel is a duo that can expand to a trio?
Well, yeah, we work with Shane Stoneback when we record.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't travel with us. When we've been playing live, we did a lot of shows last year in Europe, and not a lot, but a number of shows in which we played with Josef van Vissem live. Mm-hmm. And so he's a squirrel, an ancillary squirrel. And we will be playing, we'll be playing with him also live at the Big Ears Festival in Knoxville. We will be playing at Mission Creek, all of this in March and April, and we will, I think we're playing a show at Third Man at Jack White's place in Nashville. So So we love playing live with Yosef. That becomes 12-string electric, 6-string electric, vocals, drums, loops, stuff like that. So,
what about the lute?
Well,
Yosef is primarily a lute player.
Yes, and he did beautiful things, created beautiful music for the score of our film, Only Lovers Left Alive. But when we play together as Squirrel, he does not play lute. He plays electric 12-string. We got a recent email from someone, and I think there was a spell check concerning Yosef from Europe, and it said Yosef Van Nuisance. So from now on, that's what I'm calling
Van
him.
Van Nuisance?
Yosef Van Nuisance, I think, is very appropriate.
Now, some years ago, you and Yosef were in this room playing on my other show, On New Sounds. I want to give listeners a taste of what that sounded like, because it kind of plays into some of the things we've been talking about. This going back to 2011, Jim Jarmusch playing the electric guitar, Yosef Van Wissem, the Dutch lute player. So that's a live performance here in our studio. It was done for my other show, New Sounds, back in 2011. My guest, Jim Jarmusch, the filmmaker, writer, director, and electric guitarist. Yosef Van Wissem, the Dutch lute player. And I wanted to play this, Jim, because it goes to a couple of different things that we've been talking about. One of them is this idea of the drone. You know, I mean, it's not that you're actually playing a drone, but you are certainly suggesting one with the way the guitar is distorted, and it's abstract. It's not a kind of, here's my guitar solo, watch how fast I can play. You know, it's...
Yeah. Well, it's more kind of textural. It's kind of receding into the background with the lute as the foreground. It's also something that relates to a lot of things that interest me, which is mixing things from different periods of history. So a lute with an electric guitar and an electric guitar basically manipulating feedback. I love these things. I love making music with synthesizers and distorted things, loops and stuff with films from the 1920s of Man Ray. I just like this mixing of things. Sometimes they just go together so beautifully that you wouldn't really expect.
Mm-hmm. And the Man Ray films from the 1920s, you know, you mentioned before the kind of musicality and the rhythm of it. Jazz was very much in the air. I'm not sure I would want to see these films with a jazz score.
Well, there's something nice for us because we play slow, droney stuff that shifts more than hits you rhythmically with changes.
Yeah.
And the films are the opposite. So that juxtaposition goes together. I think if we tried to make real fast music to quick-cut films, it wouldn't have the same thing.
Yeah. The other thing with this piece of music we just heard is the title was Concerning the Beautiful Human Form After Death. And many of the works that you and Yosef have done over the years have had titles drawn from, like, the writings of various Christian mystics.
Yeah.
Is that a shared interest with Yosef as well?
Well, it's Yosef. These are Yosef's titles. It's shared in that we find links. He found William Blake through Swedenborg.
Right.
I found Swedenborg through William Blake. You know, these kind of things that connect by things that we have as mutual interests. But it's, yeah, those titles are Yosef's titles,
yeah.
Which I like very much, but I don't interfere with them. I don't change them or suggest anything.
And the idea of this, of the drone, you know, it comes through in lots of ways in your work. There's a great scene in Only Lovers Left Alive where Yasmin Hamdan, the Lebanese singer, she's in this cafe in Morocco, and Tom and Tilda's characters are kind of peering in as she's singing, and the whole thing is over a drone. And you talk about liking ways of connecting things that are separated in time. That's a way of connecting things that are separated geographically. The drone seems to be kind of universal.
Well, it is. You know, it's in all types of music. It's in music that's very mystical, magical. It's a kind of hypnotic thing. But you find it even in 20th century classical music. You find it in music from North Africa especially. You find it certainly in Indian classical music. And you find it in certain forms of rock and roll. I think there's something too about it being imperfect that I think is important. I think we find magic in imperfection, mm-hmm. and in perfection we find less magic. It's like, certain Native American tribes in the Southwest, if they make a basket or some pottery, they will make sure it's asymmetrical, the pattern. Because if it's symmetrical, it's devoid of magic. I'm not sure how that relates particularly to the drone, but it does to kind of distortion and broken sound, and often drones in other types of music have some kind of distortion mm-hmm. element to them, a kind of a ringing, or I don't know. It's a way to hypnotize your audience.
Is there a cinematic equivalent to the drone?
Wow. I'm sure there are equivalents. I'm not prepared to answer that. I have to think about that for a while, whether it's something in the style of Béliard or, you know, I'm not quite sure, or even Jacques Rivette sometimes.
I just, off the top of my head, I'm thinking the Texas landscape that Wim Wenders sets Paris, Texas in.
Yeah.
Is kind of a visual drone, you know, this endless horizon, this kind of sense of space. I don't know. You're the filmmaker. That's why I'm asking you.
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm sure there are many references we could find, but we're kind of stretching two different things. But, they all interrelate for me. That's what I love, is when things kind of, different forms suggest other forms.
Well, now, this has been another part of your career that, you know, which is one of the reasons I asked you to do the Man Ray thing, was that you've connected music and film so closely throughout your life. Going back to, you know, the Del Byzantines, where you and Phil Klein, the composer, were in a rock band together.
Yeah.
And that was basically how it worked back in New York, downtown in the late 70s, early 80s, right? You know, filmmakers were making music.
Oh, yeah.
And
everybody.
Photographers were
the painter/filmmaker James Nares was a drummer in the Del Byzantines and previously a guitarist in the Contortions. You know, it mm-hmm. was, there was a point there that I loved in the late 70s where someone put flyers up all over the East Village that said, "Everyone here is in a band." Which was pretty accurate.
It was,
you know?
Pretty true, yeah.
But that thing of also incorporating, like, Phil Klein, he's my old friend. He's a great musician. We're from Ohio. We grew up together. He's a real musician. He knows music theory, everything. I'm a non-musician, but very musical. So there was no problem in us making a band. You know, it was like there was a kind of openness to different approaches that were not necessarily the conventional mainstream commercial ones, obviously.
Right. So. And you and Phil are involved in a current project, which is a huge endeavor, and again, might take us back to this conversation about abstraction versus narrative. But before we get to that, I want to give people a chance to hear. I'm going to embarrass you by playing a little Del Byzantines.
Okay.
This is the song Girls' Imagination. This is Jim Jarmusch, Phil Klein et al., circa 1981. So that's 3 years before Down by Law. So my first introduction to you, Jim, was as a musician. There you're singing and playing keyboards. Phil Klein is singing and playing guitar.
Yeah.
I think that's James Nares.
That's James on drums and Philippe Van Hagen on bass. And the lyrics from the song are from Luc Sant, who's also our old friend.
Great writer.
Great writer. That we love. So... At least the lyrics are cool. No, the music, you know, you can hear a kind of post-punk, Bowie-esque thing. We were inspired by all these different things going on.
Mm-hmm. What were you listening to back then?
Well, we were listening to all kinds of things from, you know, gamelan music to Harry Parch. To, you know, Conlon Nancaro. To, of course, like Lou Reed and Bowie and a lot of British stuff. And for some reason, the Del Byzantines, well, it was really because of our manager. She would get us opening slots before British bands. So we opened a lot for Echo and the Bunnymen. We opened for... The Psychedelic Furs, you know, it's kind of Brit bands of this period.
Yeah. So was there at some point in the early 80s a moment where you came to a fork in the road and had to make a decision? Which road do I pursue?
There kind of was, yeah. And it was in the dressing room in the basement of something that had formerly been a German bank. And we were opening for the Four Tops, with a kind of frat boy crowd hurling beer and vomit at us. And then afterwards, the toilets broke in our dressing room, so there was about 2 inches of fluid on the water with our equipment and our clothes and stuff. And we weren't getting along so well, and I think that was like sort of it for me. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to work on films for a while. And that sounds kind of weak now, like, well, gee, you couldn't stand up for your... But the whole band had feelings of like, well, something was changing, and we were all starting to do other things.
But now you and Phil are involved in this opera about Nikola Tesla.
Yeah.
And Robert Wilson, the American dramatist, has been brought on board. And so now here's a guy whose whole approach to theater goes back to what we were talking about before, abstract versus narrative.
Yeah, completely. I mean, even that he calls these things operas is already a stretch. He finds his own form, Bob Wilson, and he's worked with amazing people. And he has a very interesting way of working, of gathering ideas, both visual and, you know, verbal, musical, and sort of, I don't know, guiding the process to find striking things that would accumulate and become a whole. But, you know, it's a very mysterious process.
Sounds like what you do as a director.
Well, I have much more of a, believe it or not, I actually have scripts and a map and, you know, and so
but
does...
But he has storyboards.
No, he does. And... He does. But it takes a while to, I guess, collect them and, yeah. and structure them, you know.
Does it sound like an opera?
Well, it's in progress. There is some music that Phil and I are actually creating together that is feedback, electric, drone type stuff. Then Phil is writing other things. Phil is the composer of the piece. I mean, I'm included in some of the music, but how much I don't know. But you know, he's writing a variety of different forms, and I think he's finding that right now. Mm. So he has some actual song type arias, and then he has some much more dark and different kind of music. So he's finding it actually.
Yeah.
And he's written a lot of music, but he told me recently, yeah, about half of what I wrote now will not be used, and I'm going in a different direction. So,
well, you know, I know he's been talking about this project forever, and it's a long-term thing. And it actually reminds me of, we heard you and Yosef Van Wissem from 2011. When you came in that day, I remember you saying, well, you know, we're working on some music for a film I'm hoping to make that I've been working on for many years. And that, of course, turned out to be Only Lovers Left Alive. So is that when people sort of hold you up as an exemplar of independent filmmaking, is that really what it means, is that it takes years to get something to fruition?
Well, for me, it does. Some people are much faster than me, and I sometimes am embarrassed. But I'm also, it's, people don't realize how busy I am. They think, well, you made a film a few years ago. What else are you doing, you know? So, for example, we're preparing this piece with Robert Wilson, and Carter and I are doing these scores. And then Squirrel is recording and releasing other music as well. I'm preparing a new feature film for next fall that'll be filmed here in New York and New Jersey. I also have an ongoing project for a book of photographs with my brother, Tom, who is an amazing photographer. So we're preparing a book together. So, man, I have a lot of projects going on. They just are evolving at their own pace.
Right, right.
So I'm very busy, but sometimes people think, well, what do you do all day? You know? But, man, I do a lot of things.
Yeah.
So,
what is your normal process, if there is a normal process, for dealing with music when you're, say, right now, in the stage that you are for this next film? Where are you in the musical choice process?
Well, the music is so important to me, and they're always so intertwined that I am just in the very early stages of exploring the possibility of a kind of electronic score, which I've never used before. So something's pulling me toward that because I love a lot of electronic music, and I haven't used it in a film, really.
Uh-huh. Do you mean like the cosmic Morton Subotnick Silver Apples of the Moon kind of electronic stuff? Do you mean Calvin Harris electronic dance music? Do you mean something more Tangerine Dream? There's a lot of ways you can take that.
Yeah, true. I don't know. I'd say like Cluster to Eno to, I don't know if you know, like, Fuck Buttons.
Sure.
Can I say that?
Yeah.
You know, some variety of things that interest me. I mean, but, you know, I like Detroit House and all kinds of electronic aberrations. So I'm not exactly sure, but I do want it to be music that kind of lets you float along. I don't want a heavy beat.
Right.
Maybe no rhythm at all in it. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. And this drives, you like to have this kind of in your mind's ear before you actually start shooting?
Yeah, I'm just gathering it now. Yeah. But, I could switch over and say, instead of electronic stuff, I'm going for only string orchestra in the end. I don't know, really. Which another beautiful form of drones are string, you know, just stringed instruments mm-hmm. play drones by their nature, which is so beautiful.
So how different was this process of working on the Man Ray films, where you had something kind of fully formed and then you had to come at it from the exact opposite direction?
Well, it was different because we were reacting to something. And when we just record with Squirrel or make music with Squirrel, we're reacting just to each other and music we're generating. So, yeah, that gives you a very beautiful kind of map or, you know how long it's going to be, which usually we don't, and mm-hmm. we don't really care. And it gives you a structure to kind of try to not accentuate in a way. But, you know, the films are very structured in their non-logical way.
Yeah. Well, the films by Man Ray, there are four of them, will get their premieres with the new scores by Squirrel, which is my guest, Jim Jarmusch and Carter Logan, at the Winter Garden Atrium, Brookfield Place, here in Lower Manhattan. Two shows, February 17th and 19th, alternating with Blanca Nieves. Have you seen this film, this contemporary Spanish?
No, I've read about it.
Beautiful.
I have not seen it.
It's really beautiful.
Wow.
So we've got an action-packed four nights at Brookfield Place between February 17th and 20th. Jim Jarmusch with me here in the Soundcheck studio. Jim, always good to see you. Thanks.
You too. Thanks for having me.
If you like Soundcheck, consider subscribing to our podcast. It's easy. Just find us in the iTunes store and click on Subscribe. We'll send you our latest interviews, in-studio performances, and more.